The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Uncle Sam wants you, but Uncle Don wants Muslims to stay away from the United States. Donald Trump's outbursts have defined the Republican primary election in the early going. Has Trump come up around your dinner table?
This is Jeannie Jones in Holiday, Utah. We are a country of immigrants. I am 100% behind refugees and Muslims coming into the U.S. I try to put myself in their place. They are desperate.
Andrew Height from Plano, Texas. I think it's a natural reaction to fear and terrorism, but I think we're at the precipice of committing an act that is un-American. Our friends and family all agree that we need to accept these people and show them the value of freedom, not continue to give them more hardships and reasons to hate.
From St. Paul, Minnesota, the country will eventually lose its core roots and values based on the number of refugees we take in and how fast they reproduce. What happens in 50 years when the English language is not the majority here? Shut the borders and take care of our own. It's a familiar impulse to Gerard Araud, ambassador of France to the United States. He says his country is looking inward since well before the victories of the far-right National Front Party in regional French elections over the weekend.
What is the most important is really this shift, I think, of a part of our middle classes to the right. Immigration has become everywhere the point of reference of our far rights.
In a wide-ranging conversation with the ambassador, he balanced pessimism in domestic politics with an optimism about the Conference of the Parties COP21 meeting in Paris, working on an agreement to reduce global emissions by the end of the week. Gerard Araud says despite many distractions, the conference has been a model for cooperation.
This conference is quite important and, in a sense, critical, not only because we should have, at the end of this negotiation, you know, Friday or Saturday, we should have a convention, a universal convention about climate change, but also because Paris should be the tipping point. What do I mean? You know, fighting climate change, it's not only a question of governments deciding. It's changing our way of life. It will take decades. And we won't do it from top-down decisions. We need the mobilization of everybody, which means the cities, which really are emitting 70% of the world emissions. We need also the business world, the local authorities, the NGOs, the civil society. So what we are trying to do in Paris is to get all these actors to say we are serious about low-carbon economy.
Would you say that there's an inconsistency in that climate change is going to be all about changing our way of life to deal with global warming, and yet the nationalist movement in France is all about trying to prevent change from happening in a way of life that's perceived to be one way of doing things and mixing with immigrants and embracing a more global world is changing the way France views itself as France?
You know, we are all facing the same challenge in this country. You know, really, if you listen to the declaration of some candidates on the right side, all over Europe, there is some people who are refusing, in a sense, to adjust to the fact that there is a climate change and that we have to face it. I think not more in France than elsewhere. And in a sense, if you look at the polls, less in France than in the U.S. But nevertheless, I think the French government, really right now, has decided to be very forceful on this issue. That's the reason why we have been candidate to hosting this conference, which frankly was taking a huge risk of failure.
Let's talk about Trump and Le Pen, since you compared them. Le Pen is a phenomenon that relates to this family and this dynasty of politicians, but it's also an organized movement that's been going on for quite a while in France. How do you see the differences between something that's been going on for years in France and someone like Donald Trump, who's popping off in the middle of a campaign, but nevertheless getting an enormous amount of attention?
You know, What I observe in the European societies and in the American society, maybe because of my age, I come from the 70s, is how much our Western societies have shifted to the right in the last decades. And of course, this shift to the right has taken several different aspects according to the political cultures and political histories. But you can't always emphasize the differences. It's obvious that we don't have the same political system, we don't have the same history. But I think what is the most important is really this shift, I think, of a part of our middle classes to the right. As for the Le Pen dynasty, you know, but the father, in a sense, was a sort of provocateur. We didn't want the power. He was the outsider, and he was relishing in his role as an outsider, while his daughter has a very different strategy. And in a sense, I guess she's quite successful.
Do you talk with people in your country about what's going on in the United States right now in our reaction to the immigrant crisis or immigrant issue? What do you think is going on in the United States in your conversations?
I think, again, as in a sense, in my conversation with my American friends and my European friends, I am emphasizing the fact that our political crises are, in a sense, comparable. That we have, as I have said, the same middle class which feels threatened by the globalization. There are people who don't have a passport, who don't travel, or who don't speak foreign language, and who are afraid, worried for the future of their own children. For me, I think it's more important to try to explain to the Europeans that Trump is not such an exotic phenomenon, that, you know, to quote somebody, Trumpism is a transatlantic phenomenon. So it's a common challenge to our Western societies.
Finally, where was your heart on November 13th, Ambassador?
It was terrible, and it was devastating. We knew that there was the risk of a new terrorist attacks, and of course it was heartbreaking, first for the victims, the people who were killed, but also for the future of the country, because one of the goals is not only to kill, is obviously to create a backlash against the Muslims. And the Muslims are part of our national community. So it's dividing our national community. Already at the attack of January with the terrorists killing Jews in a kosher superstore was also dreadful. So, no, it's a very difficult moment. I'm on phone with my friends in Paris, and after the attacks, and to be frank, also after the result of the elections, as we say in French, you know, they have a heavy heart.
It's a tough year for you and your countrymen.
Yeah, inshallah.
Inshallah. Inshallah indeed. Gerard Arnault is Ambassador of France to the United States. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you very much.
Speaking of climate change, has oil become an unwanted commodity all of a sudden? The slide in prices suggests something is going on. Oil is trading at a 7-year low, closing Tuesday below $40 a barrel, following OPEC's failure last week to cap output led by Saudi Arabia's surge in production. Energy analysts predict the price could go lower in the next 12 months, but Dan Dicker, oil analyst for The Street and oilprice.com, and author of Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America, says we could be in for a wild ride that will eventually drive oil back up, way up.
I think there could easily be. Now, I know this is, you know, I'm way off the regular analyst radar when I say this, but I think there could be a change of 4 to 5 million barrels over the course of the next 22, 23 months in terms of what comes offline in terms of supply and what gets added in terms of demand. Now, 5 million barrels a day from where we are now, it would make a huge difference in the price of oil. And in fact, I'm looking for prices in three digits as early as 2017.
No kidding.
Yes.
What number can't the Saudis compensate for by increased production? In other words, 2 million they can handle, 3 million they can handle, 5 million they can't handle? a day, barrels a day?
I think that they're literally, and again, I'm on the other side of this, as close to full production capabilities as they're going to get. They're at a little more than 11 million barrels a day. And we talked about, you know, spare capacity for years with the Saudis, with an sort of an unknown kind of with a question mark on how much spare capacity they had. In other words, how much can they ultimately pump if they wanted to just open up the spigots full bore? And, you know, this 11 million barrels a day has absolutely shocked the analysts, you know, from their predictions 2, 3, 4 years ago. And I think that the limits have really been reached in terms of Saudi production. There are other members in OPEC we know that have great potential to increase production, provided they get the money and the resources. Iran is one. Iraq is another. I mean, the potential there is huge. But with all that's going on there geopolitically, obviously that's not a great bet to increase production, you know, 2 or 3-fold over the next 3 or 4 years.
So the Saudis don't have more cards to play, but we are in a situation that is very unusual. Demand is a mystery. Supply is a mystery. And the motives of the players are all kind of mysterious right now.
I don't know whether the motives of the players, I kind of...
Well, they're all greedy, but what they're going to do at any given moment is not clear.
It's like watching a big game theory kind of experiment play out. You know, if everyone goes into a room, you know, with blindfolds on, and they all decide at once not to screw their neighbor, then everybody comes out well, and in the end, you find that most of the time, you know, people and companies and countries tend to take care of themselves first and forget about, you know, generalized game theory.
Well, stumbling around in the dark certainly describes the situation we're in right now, that's for sure.
I think that's right.
Any spikes that you see over the next 12 months?
No, I think oil prices remain low, and that's good for consumers. I think gas prices remain low. There's still a major glut in production that's still online. Huge stockpiles, as large as we've probably ever seen them, and those will take time to clear, and therefore prices should stay relatively low. And when I mean relatively low, I mean under $50 a barrel for at least the next 6 to 8 months until some of that surplus gets used.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you, John.
Dan Ticker, oil analyst for The Street and oilprice.com, and author of Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. America's Industrial Revolution began in New Jersey. The slogan from 1935, Trenton makes, the world takes, is the name on a railroad bridge in New Jersey built in the early 1800s. Everything from silk to sewing machines was made in the Garden State at one time, and the retreat of the manufacturing economy left a footprint of toxic waste often invisible to citizens living nearby and unknown to communities that have grown up on sites long abandoned. Investigator Sarah Gonzalez, a reporter for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio, has produced Dirty Little Secrets, a series all about unearthing what is unknown about the ground beneath the feet of so many New Jersey citizens.
The information that's available at the state's Department of Environmental Protection, there's no way to really look at what the contamination landscape is like in New Jersey. The DEP told me you basically have to go to the site of where the contamination is, look for a sign. On that sign, there should be a phone number to the person assigned to address the contamination, investigate the contamination, call that person. And if that person decides to call you back, then you can get more information. I will say there are reports available online. You can search what's called the PI number. It's kind of like the site identification number, but it's pretty cryptic. I mean, unless you know the environmental contamination jargon, you really can't make out what the nature of the contamination is there and what the status of any cleanup is.
Well, some people get pretty alarming signs of the contamination without having to call any phone numbers or look for any signs. What do residents of Newark think about the suspicious sites that are in their own neighborhoods?
Right. So one of the things that we heard a lot was that some contamination you can kind of there are signs that there is a contaminated site. Smell is usually one of the big signs. But a lot of this contamination doesn't smell, and you have no way of knowing that you are breathing in toxic fumes until someone comes out and investigates the air quality or tests the soil or tests the groundwater. So this is Modesto Vieira. He's a resident in the Ironbound neighborhood in Newark, and he found out that he had been breathing in toxic fumes from an old lighter fluid factory for years before the state became became aware of it.
It was like a gassy smell, and we couldn't figure out what it was. We thought the house was dirty, the pipes were not cleaned or something. And sometimes I kind of felt that I was out of breath, and that could have been the problem, I don't know. But ever since they dug the holes in here, the air has gotten better, and I don't feel the headache as much.
So this the home that he's on, when I actually went there, the site of the contamination is called Ronson Metals Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go out there with the kind of community advocate, and I'm looking for Ronson Metals Corporation, and I get to this cul-de-sac, and it's a row of condos. And I'm like, where's Ronson Metals? And she's like, this is Ronson Metals. Homes were never supposed to be built on here, and they were, because there's just very little communication between the state and developers. And so the DEP eventually, when they became aware of it, they stepped in, they tested the soil, and they installed these air filters. It's basically like an exhaust pipe. It's kind of like a Band-Aid to the contamination is still there, but at least it's not harming people. And the states, if they become aware that something is harming residents, they'll step in, even if the original polluter or the developer, you know, doesn't step in, and they put in these sort of fixes.
Mm.
But the contamination, like the source of the contamination, it's still there. It's still underground.
And of course, kids playing in the yard has nothing to do with them. What do activists say about the social justice implications of the people who are really close to these sites compared with the general population of New Jersey?
So WNYC's data news team mapped out all of the contaminated sites in New Jersey. There are some that are considered immediate environmental concerns, but there are sort of Band-Aids in place. There are sites where nobody has been hired to clean up the contamination, and then there are sites where somebody has been hired to clean up the contamination. And we looked at where all of these sites are in relation to people. And we found that 90% of New Jerseyans live within a mile of a contaminated site, of any sort of contaminated site. So basically the entire state. But then we looked at the sites where no one has been hired to clean up the contamination. And we found that 75% of people who live below the poverty line in New Jersey live within a mile of one of these sites. And it's 75% of the state's Black population, 80% of the state's Hispanic population. They are living near one of these sites that have no cleanup plan. And what we found was that, I mean, everyone I spoke with, the DEP, developers, the owners of these contaminated sites, they all told me that what triggers the cleanup of a contaminated site is usually some kind of transaction, so like the sale of a property.
Mm.
So if some developer wants to buy this contaminated property, remediate it, put condos on it, you know, then it'll get cleaned up. If there's no interest, it's just kind of up to the owner of the site to clean it up, and it's expensive, and the owners of these sites are not always the original polluters.
So you've got a spiral in places like Camden and Newark. You've got lower real estate prices because these are on contaminated sites. There's no remediation unless there's a transaction, but these are places where the real estate values are declining anyway, so it's not like a hotbed of real estate interest. So therefore, these places stay neglected and stay neglected and stay neglected.
Right. And I want to be clear. The DEP says, you know, these are not sites where people are at risk. And if they find out, oh, we know that this was like some smelting plant, then they will go, they'll test the soil, and they will step in.
So, Sarah, how did New Jersey decide to outsource this remediation work to move to a privatized system?
I mean, it was supposed to be a solution to the problem. In 2006, the DEP learned that kids at a daycare center in South Jersey had really high levels of mercury in their bodies, because it had turned out that this daycare center was allowed to open in an old thermometer factory. And so a couple years after that, the state legislature, the governor at the time, he decided to outsource the cleanup. Everyone admitted, we're not getting to these sites fast enough. And so they decided, let's bring in outside private contractors, let them address the contamination, and then we can get to these sites faster.
Sarah Gonzalez, thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Sarah Gonzalez, reporter with WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. WNYC's data news team mapped out all of the contamination sites in the state, from those with no cleanup plan to those with immediate environmental concerns. And you can find the toxic sites near you if you're a New Jersey resident at WNYC.org. Refugees, Muslims, fear of terrorism. How are you talking about all this among your families and coworkers?
This is Bruce Bennett from Plano, Texas. Unlike previous waves of immigrants caused by war and famine, Muslim immigrants show little desire to assimilate in Western countries. I don't believe it makes sense to bring them here where they quickly become disgruntled and dissatisfied with our way of life.
Our way of life is to invite you to give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and there's always more at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on photo editing, public speaking, Python, and more. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
America has never embraced the full concept of reconciliation regarding slavery, even though other nations, Rwanda and South Africa, to use just two examples, have obtained a measure of healing by creating a way to account for the wounds of genocide or apartheid. The farthest the U.S. has gone to redress slavery is the notion of affirmative action, far from the idea of reparations or reconciliation. It's a doctrine with its roots in the Reconstruction period and which reached a peak after the Civil Rights Movement. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy issued Executive Order 10925, which established the President's Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity. But the pendulum would swing away from affirmative action, reconciliation, and this idea of reparations in 1978, when the Supreme Court ruled in the case Regents of the University of California versus Bakke, that using racial quotas in college admissions violated the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. As a compromise measure, the court added that race could be considered as one of a number of factors in admissions in order to promote diversity of the student body. Elements of that diversity mission are being challenged today in oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. How do students feel about all this? Janelle Benson is a sophomore at the University of Texas at Austin. The University of Texas case is being argued before the Supreme Court today. She is majoring in African and African diaspora studies and is the president of the Black Student Alliance. Janelle says backing away from affirmative action over time has made an honest racial discussion more difficult on campus. Diversity has become a kind of cover-up, she says.
The conversation around reparations, obviously, on campuses have been hindered because the conversation has been tapered kind of to talk about diversity and not really talk about reparations and kind of giving back to the communities that things were taken from.
And whites look at this discussion of diversity and see a sort of, well, it's much better to have diversity. But diversity, it sounds like you're saying, is also a set of blinders that allows you to purely view race in this sociological term without recognizing historical crimes and the consequences of those historical crimes. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. What we see a lot of the times is the word diverse is too general. And so when we say diverse, what do we mean by diverse and what does diversity look like? And of course, that'll be different depending on what campus you're talking about, you know, kind of what field you're in, what diversity looks like. To kind of just center the conversation around diversity hinders the movement and kind of hinders the progress that we're really trying to make.
How do you think the broader issues of race in the United States have had an impact on your campus? How are you, for instance, focused on Black Lives Matter? How has that made its way into the discourse at the University of Texas? Do you think affirmative action has any impact on that at all?
You know, the Black student population here is not as high as we would like it to be. But when we talk about Black Lives Matter, we definitely talk about Black education, and we talk about the racial progress of Blacks in America. And so here on the University of Texas, especially my organization, the Black Student Alliance, we try to make sure the students feel comfortable on campus. And so when we are participating in demonstrations and protests that go with the national movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, we make sure the students understand what that movement means and what that movement can do for the students on our campus. So students have a space to a freedom to express themselves. They have the ability to really just use the movement on the campus and use the national movements to make impacts on our campus. When we talk about Mike Brown and then when we talk about the ruling and the Mike Brown shooting, the different tragedies, when we talk about South Carolina and how that plays into the Black Lives Matter movement, that definitely helps with progress on our campus. And the movements and the national recognition helps the students on our campus get recognition for the smaller things, like the Jefferson Davis statue. You know, that was a national thing after the tragedy in South Carolina. National movements have a big impact on our campus.
Would you say there's more solidarity between black students at the University of Texas and the black students at the University of Missouri who are dealing with a serious issue of tolerance on that campus, right, or that the black students at the University of Texas finding more solidarity with other students at the University of Texas? You know what I mean?
Right. So we have had a close relationship over the past couple of months with Mizzou. But in the past, we have seen some solidarity with other campus groups, the Black Student Alliance and Israeli Students Association. There's other, you know, campus entities and campus groups that reach out and they talk about social justice, and they kind of have these forums that talk about how Black people can play a role in some of these other social movements and other social justice movements.
Finally, Janelle, if you were able to, be at the oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court, and if you were able to say, you know, don't forget, justices, that for all the legal theory and legal issues here, this is a very tangible question of history along with law. How would you make that case before the justices?
I would say that education and really properly educating our students here in America about racism and about the racial wrongdoings in the past. In class, when we're sitting in a history class or a political theory class and we're talking about racism, if there's not a student from a different background, a non-Black student of color, if they don't have that opinion, if they don't have that dialogue and they can't exchange that dialogue, if our non-Black students can't have that dialogue with Black students, then it's like, where are they going? Where's the progress going? You know, individual ignorance sustains institutional racism. And, you know, that's something that I stick by. So if we're not educating our white students on what it's like to be Black and what it's like to be a minority student or what it's like to be a minority in America, period, then, you know, they can't make an impact on their communities.
Janelle Benson is a sophomore at the University of Texas at Austin. She is majoring in African and African Diaspora Studies and is the president of the Black Student Alliance. Years of affirmative action programs and embracing the diversity mission have changed the student populations of schools in America. How has your school changed over time? Fort Lauderdale, Florida. My elementary school in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, had a lot of children of Holocaust survivors, Norwegians and Italians in the middle of the century. It is now a largely Chinese neighborhood today.
In my high school, I was one of hundreds of military brats. We were stationed in Germany, and we represented a diverse community in terms of ethnicity and culture, language, and socioeconomic indicators. I now live mostly in mostly white Portland, Oregon, and my neighbors, my kids' schools, each have a lot less diverse peers than I did.
St. Augustine, Florida. I was born in the Congo, and we moved to Nashville when I was in sixth grade. I was bused across town to a predominantly black school 45 minutes each way. It was then that I experienced my first bullying, and it was culture shock, to say the least. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, which has funded research that led to blood cancer treatments such as chemotherapy and stem cell transplants, and more recently, targeted therapies and immunotherapies to save thousands of lives. More at lls.org. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Most people in France know or have often heard the Arabic word inshallah, God willing, that the French ambassador to the United States, Gerard Araud, used in our conversation earlier this hour. 7.5% of the French are Muslim, and it's been that way for generations. Yet that familiarity didn't prevent the Paris attacks, nor did it discourage right-wing nationalists from making significant gains in local elections. Fear of immigrants and people of different religions gave Donald Trump an opportunity this week to use some inflammatory rhetoric about Islam. How do faith communities take on such rhetoric beyond the occasional well-meaning inshallah? Camila Rashad is Muslim chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania, and Rabbi Jenny Rosen is vice president for community engagement with HIAS, an international migrant and refugee resettlement agency. They both say Trump was wrong, but it's also wrong to dismiss him by calling him evil.
I think that it is never right to demonize any particular group of people.
and that the rising xenophobia and Islamophobia that we're seeing is abhorrent. It's absolutely abhorrent. I think that this is something that religious leaders must stand up to. I think that we see instances of Jews and Muslims and Christian leaders coming together. In our work resettling refugees, we resettle a large number of Muslim refugees across the country. And whether in San Diego or Toledo or Pittsburgh or Springfield, Massachusetts, we're working with local Muslim organizations in this work as a Jewish agency. And I think this is so important because of the political rhetoric that you're talking about.
American political rhetoric is filled with irresponsible comparisons and, you know, evocations of ultimate evil when maybe it's inappropriate. Do you think that's what's going on here?
I think there's absolutely a sense of growing darkness, which is actually an interesting thing to have at this particular time. We're at the time of the year that is actually literally the darkest time of the year. Tonight is the fourth night of Hanukkah, and Hanukkah is a story and a holiday about light overtaking darkness and feeling like the forces of darkness are gathering strength. And yet it's also it's a holiday about increasing light, and that each night every night add a candle to the menorah, to the light that we are building. And I think that this is really what religious leaders are called to do at this time, to magnify and multiply light in this time of darkness.
Any thoughts on this notion of evil, Camilla?
Well, I think it's dangerous on our part to kind of characterize an individual as evil. I think what he's doing is definitely extremely detrimental to all of us, not just to the American Muslim community. But there's a point at which, again, this offers us an opportunity to show that interfaith solidarity, to show, again, the values that we aspire to as Americans, and to say this is not an accurate reflection of who we are or who we want to be. And I think kind of characterizing him in those, you know, very sensational kind of depictions begins to eliminate some of the personal accountability that each and every American has to really wrestle with on a daily basis. So whatever, you know, kind of shortcomings or even strengths that he may have is really being overshadowed by how this line of rhetoric is resonating throughout the country. And so we cannot characterize thousands in his audience who are applauding as evil. We can say that they're misinformed, that they're perhaps fearful of the unknown, that they are also kind of giving in to some of their darkest emotions and feelings. So each one of us has an opportunity, and it presents kind of a really beautiful challenge for us to say this is not how we want to be depicted across the globe.
You know, I can't resist asking this because it relates to something that a young law student said to us this week, that this is actually a better definition of jihad than what Trump would have us believe. This idea that you have to fight with your own personal inner darkest impulses, that's the jihad that is taught in the mosques around the world and in the United States. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. I mean, the definition, and American Muslims have really struggled with how to explain in a nuanced way all that word encapsulates. And it really is about the struggle with your kind of deepest fears and desires, with what we call your nafs, with yourself. So the struggle begins internally, and that is to emulate the values of our religion, which is of empathy and mercy and compassion. And so we know that we are all human. You know, we have those moments where we don't show compassion, we don't show empathy, but we can't allow what could be the ugly sides of ourselves to overtake who we are as people. And so that definition of jihad, it really begins with critical self-reflection, self-awareness. That struggle is constant, is daily. But I believe that we all have an opportunity, again, to demonstrate through our actions and our words, our behavior, how we can overcome what could be kind of unchecked, unrestrained intolerance and hate. I think that is the darkest, most evil side of who we are. But it's not an accurate reflection of who we want to be.
I think there's also a sense in which it can be an act of courage to welcome the stranger. Part of why our tradition comes to teach us to welcome the stranger and to love the stranger is to really charge us to rise to meet that challenge. If it were easy to do, it wouldn't necessarily be a value that we would need to be reminded of and remind ourselves of.
So I think in light of the recent attacks, there's fear. And I think that fear is understandable. But I think that fear is misplaced. And I think it's important to really understand the facts about Muslim American community, the facts about how people come here as refugees.
And this opportunity for courage. You both sort of alluded to that.
Absolutely. And I think in every generation, there has been fear and uncertainty and almost suspicion of both refugees and immigrants. And we've seen this play out generation after generation. And yet we've also seen the times when Americans really rise to their greater values. And certainly as Jews, we are calling out to say, this is not the way to treat people. This is not who we are. And absolutely need to see our way clear to really welcoming strangers and not closing our doors.
Rabbi Jenny Rosen is Vice President for Community Engagement with HIAS, formerly known as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. Rabbi, may there be more light on this fourth night of Hanukkah. Thanks so
much. Thank you.
And Camila Rashad is Muslim Chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. Camila, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today, although you can't really put it in your pocket. Cash money, paper money, is signed by the U.S. Treasurer. But if you trade in digital bitcoins, its origins are as mysterious as pirate treasure. No, you say. Satoshi Nakamoto created bitcoins back in 2009. Yes, but that name is a computer email alias, has been for years. This week, Wired and Gizmodo, who have been trying to unmask the Bitcoin crusader, claim that their sources have fingered a computer entrepreneur by the name of Craig Stephen Wright, who lives in Sydney, Australia. Within hours, Australian authorities raided his apartment on suspicion, of course, of tax evasion. Who knows? Maybe it's true. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Squarespace, a website builder that provides domains, hosting, and website templates, all with 24/7 customer support. More at squarespace.com/takeaway. Squarespace, build it beautiful. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.